You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. So welcome to episode 275, and in this one I interview Dr. Stephen Phillipson. Now, if you're a regular listener, you would have heard many episodes with Steve over the last few years, but if it's the first time you're listening to Steve, he is a licensed clinical psychologist based in New York. And in this episode, we chat specifically about his thinking around the brain voice versus the gatekeeper voice. Now, I thought this was a really interesting topic, and I think it's going to help many of you. But to be more specific, we talk about knowing the difference between the brain voice and the gatekeeper voice. We do a role play using an area that still causes me anxiety. He uses this role play to demonstrate the brain voice versus the gatekeeper. We discuss the idea of writing the headline with the gatekeeper, the paradox of anxiety, self-compassion for the brain voice, and much, much more. And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the show and the work that we do. NoCD are now operating in Australia as well as UK and USA. So good work to NoCD for continuing their expansion, and thank you to them for sponsoring the show. And if you want to find out more, head to go.treatmyocd.com/theocdstories or click the link in the episode description. And thank you, as always, for listening. I deeply appreciate it, and it means a lot. And without further ado, here is Dr. Phillipson. Welcome back to the show, Steve.
Stu, as always, it's a pleasure, something I, at this point, very much look forward to. Always find our interviews an extremely rewarding opportunity for me. And with the feedback we've been getting, I'm very happy that we're able to kind of disseminate to the community some really good topics and some good connection that we have.
Yeah, no, thank you. I appreciate it. And yeah, I had a nice email the other day about the somatic OCD episode we did. And the person didn't have that theme, but they really learned a lot in the way you explained it about their own OCD and their own themes. And for me, that's a great piece of feedback, because I want to be able to put an episode on contamination OCD, and someone with harm OCD is like, I learned a lot from that. And I think that's kind of the goal of any theme specific episodes I have. So today we're going to talk about the brain voice versus the gatekeeper voice. So just initially, whatever you want to say on those two things.
Okay, the first thing I'll say is, and people ask me whether I'm the originator of this concept, and hate to say, but I am not. In terms of using the phrase like, you know, brain voice versus gatekeeper voice, Albert Ellis really did a great deal of pioneering in what he referred to as a automatic thought, meaning that the brain is capable of sending us an idea that's completely independent of us, the gatekeeper, meaning our autonomous identity, you know, the choice maker is what I mean by the gatekeeper. So Albert Ellis did a lot of work in terms of how depressed people, that their brain sends them highly irrational associations that unfortunately they tend to endorse, and therefore depression is a very tragic byproduct of people whose brains send them this very dark and very negative, deprecating information, and then they take that voice as being substantive. I know I tragically grew up, probably like the majority of the world, not making a differentiation between what my brain told me and how I could relate to it as a separate entity and observe the voice, rather than tragically believe that that voice was the deep, dark, true identity within me. That if my brain was saying very, very negative things about me, or even conjuring up very negative associations, that this must be a very, very dark and very unhealthy representation of me as a person. I'll never forget when I used to pet my dog and it would lay on her back and I would rub her stomach, my brain would tell me to take a knife and to stab my dog. And I thought, oh my God, I must be such a horrible person. How could I have a thought to do something so horrible to the thing in my life that I love the most? And it didn't make any sense to me. And being so uneducated about it, I just thought that this was a representation of what a horrible, evil person I must be. And so unfortunately, until I learned the principles of the way the human brain worked, I grew up with a tragic sense of being a kind of an evil person, not only because of thoughts about doing violence to my own dog, but also certain associations of doing violence to other innocent people. And I just thought, you know, what a dark person, you know, what a violent person that I must be. When I learned that the brain, you know, as a machine can act independently, not only for myself, but it turns out, you know, kind of for all of us, that our brain sends us information as just pure association. And it's just offering ideas that I think it sees as being potentially important, potentially informative. And I see them often as just sort of a test. You know, it's like, hey, is this okay? Or, you know, your dog is laying vulnerable on its back. Boy, you could stab, you know, your dog and do harm. And it wasn't until, you know, I really started to develop an understanding that this was just natural brain activity that I could start really letting go of my own belief about my character being, you know, so dark and evil. So with OCD, there is exactly this tendency to, you know, have the brain produce very natural human associations, such as maybe there's AIDS on a doorknob, or maybe I am inspired to do some sexual act on my own child. And but the thing is that that's not OCD. You know, all human brains tend to conjure up these creative associations. When I'm on a cruise ship, my brain tells me to jump off the balcony, and it wonders how long I could just float around before I drown. And this is not in any way a representation of me being suicidal. I actually enjoy life. I enjoy my day-to-day existence. But, you know, on a ledge of a ship or a balcony of a tall building, or even on a train track, while the train's coming to the station, my brain tells me to perform these suicidal acts. And you know, at this point, I just welcome, you know, my brain activity. And I do not have OCD. Many patients ask me, you know, do I have OCD because of my familiarity with the condition? And I don't. I'd be happy to admit it if I did. But I just have sort of a natural human functioning brain. And I think that's really what's important, is that people recognize that having these associations is really not the hallmark of the condition of OCD. That for 95% of the population, OCD or otherwise, that our brains tend to produce these associations in a very spontaneous way. When I speak to patients about the nature of their OCD theme, they most often, almost entirely say, you know, I have thoughts such as X. And I quickly interrupt them and say, it's not you having the thoughts. If you were choosing these thoughts, then yes, we could say it's you. But what it is that their brain, the machine, is conjuring up these associations and sending them, just like my own brain, these pairings of ideas. But with OCD, there is a bonding to a cataclysmic emotional distress signal. And that distress signal is 100% authentic to a person feeling grave danger and tremendous threat and risk. And so because that emotional signal is 100% authentic and it bonds itself with these very creative mental associations, the sufferer is compelled to act in a very kind of escape-seeking way or neutralizing-seeking way to put out that emotional fire. And now you have the cycle of the condition of OCD. It's the escape response, the avoidance response, the fragility that a person experiences with this cycle of the creative thought and then the emotional distress signal. That really is the hallmark of OCD. And in order to even have a diagnosis of OCD, it means that the person's life has to be disrupted or disturbed in a very, very significant way by the condition. Let's see here. So, you know, the important thing is that the brain voice is this very spontaneous, unavoidable signal that is completely independent. And people really struggle with this concept. They say to me all the time, how do I know the difference between my brain voice and then the gatekeeper's voice? So if I have a thought, maybe I'm sexually attracted to my child, how do I know that that's just this meaningless brain association versus what I might actually desire, want, or be capable of? And the answer to that question is that there is an absence of the voluntary nature, that it just comes in visits, and then it becomes paired with a distress signal. And if we could choose be in control of our thoughts, we certainly wouldn't choose to have this association. So what I say to patients is, where you have a question as to whether it's the brain voice or the gatekeeper voice, I generally say that within that question kind of lies the answer of it being brain material and therefore not in any way substantive to a person's authentic identity or wishes. So I'll just take a break at that point and ask if you have any questions still.
No, that it makes a lot of sense. One of my questions was going to be, hey, how do you distinguish between the two? But that's pretty clear for me.
Unfortunately, what many people want to say is that, you know, the brain voice or OCD is paired with this distress signal. So, if I have a thought of being sexual with a child and I feel anxious about that, oh, goody, now I know that this is an OCD thought, and people think OCD thoughts, therefore, are meaningless. So in that regard, they often use the emotional distress signal as reassurance that it's not legitimate or substantive. Unfortunately, as people progress in treatment or as their brains will create natural associations, sometimes these thoughts will occur without any emotional distress. I mean, when my brain sends me signals of jumping in front of a train or stabbing my dog, I would never really get anxious about those thoughts. And to this day, I give my brain total and complete license to conjure up any associations that it deems relevant in that moment. And, you know, I don't experience any anxiety with my brain's natural association. So unfortunately, you can't use anxiety as kind of the get out of jail free card to say, oh, because I'm anxious, that means I'm not really a bad person. It's just more to understand and define that the human brain just does this across the board as a natural association. And as treatment progresses, you know, the goal of therapy is not to have these thoughts come to an end. People say things like, oh, I know that I'll have OCD forever. And I say to them, no, that's not in any way the case. If you engage in aggressive ERP, you can absolutely remove OCD. Generally, I talk about it going dormant, that it can go dormant kind of like a volcano for many, many years. Just because a volcano is dormant doesn't mean that it can't erupt at some point. But, you know, a person hopefully can unpack the skills that they learned within a therapeutic paradigm and then reapply them if the brain does kind of erupt and start pairing these natural associations with anxiety.
Yeah. No, I like that. Have you got more to say on it, or should we jump into the next bit?
Oh, I was also going to say, you know, the brain is capable of sending these spontaneous associations as it is, you know, in terms of monitoring, you know, our body temperature. It's like, I'm not choosing right now to maintain my body temperature at 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And I looked it up this morning, that's 37 degrees Celsius across the big pond. You know, that we don't choose these functions. We don't choose to release acid in our stomach to digest food. And just as the machine is capable of these wonderful self-preserving associations, our brain is also capable of producing these cognitive associations. And we are no more responsible for digesting food as we are responsible for having these thoughts. And so this is one of the, I think that one of the biggest kind of sticking points in terms of OCD progress is that we just all grow up with this idea that we are our thoughts. You know, people say to me, you know, if I'm not my brain, then what, is there a different person living in me? And it's not so much that there's a different person, but there is certainly an independent mechanical system. Our brain is almost exactly like a computer. There are nerve cells in it that basically fire or don't fire. So it's almost an exact replication of a computer's zero and one system of programming. Our brain is fire or don't fire. And so, you know, the brain can fire independently, and that's the nature of anxiety, and it's also the nature of these creative thoughts. I also want to say, in terms of, you know, I use this phrase creative thoughts or creative associations, as opposed to most patients really define them as being evil or disgusting or horrible. And in the world of mindfulness, where the goal of treatment is to really show the brain the irrelevance of its associations. If we're going to decondition the machine to being highly alarmed by its own associations and really give the brain an opportunity to become habituated and accepting of its own associations, it's really important that we not stamp these labels of negativity on the brain. We have to show the brain that we, the gatekeeper, totally welcome its creative associations, that we're not going to be fragile about the associations, nor are we going to be fragile about the emotional distress signals that pair up with these mental associations.
Yeah, no, it's clear to me. I think it's an important distinction to kind of say the body, the system, the brain is doing this. It's not your fault. It's happening to you or happening within you or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Nice. I got more questions on the gatekeeper, but I want to save them for later.
Okay.
Until after the exercise.
Sure thing.
Yeah. Cool. Should we jump into the exercise or?
Let's do that. Let's do that. So I would start off by saying, okay, Stu, what brings you to Midtown Manhattan today?
Okay. Crazy traffic. Okay, I'm going to set it up for everyone because I feel silly saying it. So I'm going to use an example in my own life. So as a kid, my earliest sort of memory of intrusive thoughts, actually this is the second memory, was around sharks. And specifically, I was in Florida and it was in sharks in a swimming pool. Now, I could see that there was nothing in this clear swimming pool. You know, the water was not murky. I would jump in, sort of freak out and get straight out the corner. So I was only in for like a meter or two, and then I was jumping out the other side as far away as I could from the water so nothing could grab me or whatever it was. And then throughout my childhood, I could be in the bath and I'd suddenly get like intrusive thoughts around like sharks in the bath, so right?
Let me interrupt.
Yeah, go for it.
Because you just said exactly the phrase that is the point of our discussion today.
Yeah.
You just said, and I was hoping you would, I was hoping you'd make this mistake. You just said, I would have the thought, even in the bathtub, about there being sharks. And so that's exactly the problem, because it wasn't you who had the thoughts. You probably were aware there were not sharks in the pool, there were not sharks in the bathtub, but your brain paired up being in a water environment with the potential that sharks might kind of come up through the drain perhaps, or sharks might have jumped into the pool when no one was looking. And so your brain shared with you these associations, and your brain probably paired this association, this creative association about sharks in a pool or sharks in a bathtub, or even sharks in a freshwater lake in the middle of the UK. Your brain, you know, probably paired these associations of water equals sharks with a distress signal. And all of that, once again, is observing the machine. But go ahead.
So would it be fair for me to say I was in the bath and these thoughts occurred to me? Because I was very much aware, even as a child.
Well, you know, it's funny. These thoughts occurred to me, or I would have you say that my brain sent me the signal. You know, keeping in mind that for us to first identify that this independent system is occurring, the brain is sending you a signal. Now to engage in that mental discipline, whereas we just naturally speak by saying, oh, I had the thought of a shark being in the bathtub. That's just the natural way of communicating. But within a therapeutic recovery paradigm, we would say, my brain sent me this association. Because if you take the effort to create that distance from your brain activity, now you the gatekeeper. Now you have an opportunity to manage that thought, to respond to the thought in a way that either conveys you're giving it relevance or in a way that conveys the disregard and the acceptance of your brain's creativity. And that's really such a critical element in terms of the recovery process, whether we're talking about, you know, puro or whether we're talking about more traditional observable ritualizers like, you know, hand washers or light switch checkers. So right off the bat, yes, I would encourage you to say, in the pool, in the bathtub, your brain created this association of sharks, sent you that awareness, paired it with a distress signal, and now you, the gatekeeper, have an opportunity to manage that.
I can go on, yeah, and pull me up where needed. Like you said, as a kid, I knew there was the part of me, which I guess we're going to call the gatekeeper, knew this is rubbish. You know, there's absolutely no sharks in this bathtub. But when you're flooded with that anxiety and the thoughts are occurring to me and my brain sending them to me, I don't have any clear memories. I'm sure I got out of the bath on many occasions when it was too intense. I definitely did in the swimming pool. I'd either avoid swimming pools, or if I was in them by myself, it would almost be a no-go zone. If there's other people in, it would be tough, but I could do it. And then I guess the reason why we're using this example is 4 years ago, I was in the Lake Districts in the UK, and there's Lake Windermere, which is one of our biggest lakes, which is tiny by comparison to, I guess, something like Lake Michigan or something like that. But big for us. And it was a stormy day. It was windy. My wife and I are in this 2-person kayak, and we're kayaking. We shouldn't have gone on because it was for a lake. It shouldn't have been waves like that. And anyway, we were going around these islands in the middle of the lake, and the whole time I'm just kind of, a gatekeeper's going, this is ridiculous. But the other more overwhelming part is this automatic brain voice there's sharks, whether they're gaining on me, I can't see them. In this case, it was like one shark. It wasn't multiple. And it's the stereotypical.
Jaws had found his way to Lake Windermere.
Exactly.
Rascal. He got sick and tired of Montauk, Long Island.
Yeah, true. But then when we were stepping off on the little islands, because we wanted to explore them. They weren't big. We just wanted to explore them and get out the rain. And it was like relief when I step on the island of, you know, I'm away from the trigger. But then getting back into the boat, there's that fear of, and it's kind of like back in the danger zone for however long until we reach the next. So the whole time I'm aware it's irrational, but so it only hits me now in like situations like that. If I'm in the sea, if I'm honest, it's going to hit me quite hard. Swimming pools, it occurs to me now all the time, but I'm able to kind of show it irrelevance, as we've talked about before, and almost egg it on and be like, good, you know, I hope the one behind me is going to eat me now. And that usually shuts it down. But I'm not quite there yet in open water.
And it's interesting, you know, because on the lake you used an interesting term. You said I was overwhelmed by the anxiety. And that's a really huge part of our capacity to mindfully observe and measure whether we're willing to exercise the emotional resources to cope with the distress signal. So I often have patients objectively measure what signals their body is sending them. A patient will say, "Oh, my heart is beating rapidly." And I'll say, "Okay, from a scale of 0 to 10, how rapidly is it beating and how uncomfortable is it?" Or they'll say, "You know, my chest feels tight or my mouth is dry." And with each of these symptoms, I'll have a patient, you know, rather than just say, "I'm feeling overwhelmingly anxious," I have them very much break down each of these symptoms into the very specific individual components of what they're calling anxiety, because every body responds differently to anxiety. Some people feel like their head is getting tight. Other people feel nauseous. There are a great variety of symptoms that come with anxiety, and people have different levels of resilience to those biological signals. But when we are able to objectively observe how our body is responding, once again, we're able to decide and choose whether we have the resilience to cope with and manage these signals rather than just like, "Hey, I'm feeling anxious." And so I always say, and this is a critical part of managing OCD, where I say, you know, patients can be really good at saying, "Oh, my brain is saying that there is a shark in the pool." But you see, now, Stu, you, the gatekeeper, are writing the headline. And I always say to patients, don't let your brain voice write the headline. So patients will just share with me, "Oh, I feel very anxious because I had the thought there's a shark in the pool." Or my brain is sharing with me the thought I have a shark in the pool. And that's all well and good. They're engaging in the mindfulness exercise of identifying their brain's behavior. But they just lay that information on my lap as if there's any relevance to it. And if you're just going to share the information from the independent systems of the brain voice, you haven't even begun to engage in a therapeutic process. And so your latest illustration here is magnificent, because you said, "Yep, my brain says to me now, still in pools, there is a shark right behind you." And then you write the headline. You say, "Yep, I'm willing for you to grab me without my seeing you. I'm willing for you to chew me up into little bitty pieces." And you say often the anxiety will dissipate fairly rapidly after you deploy this very skilled, very embracing gatekeeper response. And that is actually a very common phenomenon. When we look at the brain's warning and we say, "Yep, I'm willing to die of AIDS, you know, from a doorknob," or, "Yep, I guess tonight I'm going to be molesting my kids," not as in a realistic embracing of that idea, but really giving the brain this license to share the idea of AIDS from a doorknob or share the idea of molesting your children tonight. That we just acknowledge it as brain creativity, and then we, the gatekeeper, write the headline to say, "Yes, brain, I'm giving you this independent system material." You know, I often encourage patients to say, "You know, this is not my department. Feeling anxious or calm, not my department. Having thoughts about these associations, it's not my department." In other words, I'm in no way responsible for the onset of these thoughts, the onset of these emotions, and I'm in no way responsible for feeling better or turning these thoughts off. And that's such a crucial part, because so many of my patients, they have tremendous shame and tremendous sense of inadequacy because they feel so weak that they're not able to get rid of their anxiety. They think like people who don't get anxious can feel anxious and say, "Go away," and then all of a sudden they'll feel calm, as if they should have this agency, this capacity to make choices about their thoughts or about their experiences. And it's such a sad, you know, kind of misinformation, because the machine, the brain voice, very independent stuff. And as a matter of fact, the more we try to control having these thoughts or not, the more we try to control turning off anxiety, the longer it will tend to last, because the brain is sending an anxiety signal to say, "Hey, is everything okay?" And if you're saying, "No, it's not okay because I'm feeling anxious," the brain reacts to that with more anxiety because it sees that things are out of control and that things aren't the way that they're supposed to be. But to be able to communicate, not in words, but in the spirit of acceptance, the spirit of tolerance, and mostly, as I say, the spirit of irrelevance. You know, the word irrelevance to me is the primary panacea, the universal antidote for any anxiety to convey irrelevance. We just can't say to the brain, this doesn't mean anything to me. We have to show the brain, and we can do that through exposure exercises or tremendous acceptance, like you did in the pool, to say, hey, eat me alive. I'm willing to be in this pool. I'm willing to be eaten by sharks. And if you try hard enough, Stu, you can go in that lake and you can embrace being eaten by Jaws, who's decided that, you know, England is a nice place to retire.
Yeah. Well, we have had great whites in our waters before. It's rare.
Freshwater lakes, you haven't.
No, we haven't. No, especially they don't even connect.
The Loch Ness monster crawled down from Scotland, don't you know? But I don't think that you have great whites in any of your lakes, nor even sand sharks.
No. No, I don't really have any. Okay, so, right, where do I go from here? I did have a question. Yeah, so I guess just to add clarity, though, so with the pool, so where I can use irrelevance now or acceptance, I should say, well, COVID, I don't swim at all, but before it would be... the anxiety would be like a 3 or a 4 out of 10, and I could use irrelevance. But let's say I'm in open water or the sea or in a very, let's say I'm in Florida, right, where there is a chance of sharks, you know, and then, you know, they have nets up a lot of the time, but let's say there's holes in those nets and somehow these critters get through. My anxiety is going to be like a 9 if I'm above my waist, to be fair, above my knee in Florida. It will be real hard for me to use that gatekeeper voice. I will try and then...
But once again, you're doing exactly what naughty patients do. You're just giving me this broad anxiety number. My anxiety would be at a 9. You're not saying... So, Steve, my heart would pound in a very uncomfortable way that I might feel like I'm having a heart attack. My brain sends my stomach a signal to feel nauseous, or my mouth gets dry, or I feel dizzy. I feel like I can barely stand. You're not speaking specifically about the exact symptoms that your brain, this amazing machine, is capable of sending you. And it's really interesting because... when I'm having a panic attack, and I've had only about 33 of them in my entire life, not that I'm counting, but when I have a panic attack, the first thing that I always notice is how profoundly powerful and authentic these signals are. I'm like, wow, this feels really powerful. That's the first thing that I always recognize. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing that I do is I start assessing, you know, A, my willingness to die, because after the age of 40, where you're no longer able to go crazy. And my original panic attacks were, oh, maybe I'm going to have a psychotic break. And then after age 40, I can inform everyone it's impossible to have a psychotic break. After age 40, almost it's like you'd be hit by lightning twice. So my brain said, oh, well, now that you can't go crazy anymore after age 40, it flipped over and said, now you're going to die of a heart attack, which obviously that's very capable. But, you know, so the first thing I experience is an overwhelming sense of authenticity of these very powerful signals. And what I do is I basically say to my brain, you know what, kill me now. I'm not going to call an ambulance. I'm not going to show up at an ER to have a doctor look at me and say, oh, Dr. Phillips, you just had a panic attack. I'd rather die on the tennis court. So I just kind of embrace that having these emotional signals. You know, my brain says, you're being an idiot. You're ignoring these very authentic death-like signals. And you should definitely go to the hospital. And I'm like, look, kill me now. I'm just going to stand here with the tennis racket in my hand and play as poorly as I usually do. And usually the experiences last between 3 to 5 minutes. Sometimes, occasionally, they'll last 40 minutes, and my brain will be like, it's still here. It usually goes away after 5 minutes. That means you really are having a heart attack. And I'm just like, okay, look, I'm just not going to give in to this. I'm just going to take it with me. Rarely do the symptoms ever last 40 to 45 minutes. But, you know, once again, I break them down. My head feels dizzy. My knees feel wobbly. I can sometimes feel a little bit nauseous. My mouth gets very dry. And these are all manageable yet very uncomfortable experiences that I'm familiar with. And I choose to carry on. And really important part about anxiety is it has no memory. So even though I've had maybe 8 panic attacks on the tennis court, I can't say, oh, this is just like the one 2 weeks ago, because my brain's like, that was a panic attack. This is the true heart attack. You idiot, go to the hospital. There's no memory to anxiety. The brain always says, this is the real one. 2 weeks ago, yesterday is an hour ago. That was nonsense, but this is the one you really need to attend to.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, I'm thinking about an example we've been using. Yeah, yeah, it rings true. Okay.
So when you go in the water and you're having your level 9 panic attack, what's the symptom that you're experiencing there? You're just like, nope, not willing to put up with this feeling. What's the most likely feeling that manipulates you off the out of the water?
Do you know what? I think I'm so in it that I think I'd struggle to be articulate here. It's an overwhelming sense of impending doom. Like something's coming for me. It's coming now and run. You know, that's the kind of, and then it doesn't, I don't pay attention to any symptoms because I'm like, just get out. And it's not just in this, it's been other areas in my life where it's just like, just run, just go. But yeah, on what you said, I was nodding because I don't get panic attacks often. And when I do, luckily they're not hugely intense, but there's been a couple minor ones recently, which I pinned down to just an overwhelming amount of stress that I wasn't owning. And my body was saying, you better pay attention. And I would start, if initially I was like, I'm going to faint. And I thought I was going to faint. I wasn't, I was just feeling dizzy and panicking. But at the time I was like, I'm going to pass out. And I was in a situation where it would have been not dangerous, but deeply embarrassing if I had fainted, because I was in a position of power, I guess. And then I really reflected on it. I was like, hang on a minute, that was a panic attack. I wasn't going to faint. That's ridiculous. And I looked at, so next time it happened, I was like, okay, there's that feeling of going dizzy. There's the feeling of the world closing in on me. There was a couple others. And then that allowed me to shake it much quicker because I was labeling it as panic and I was acknowledging the symptoms.
So you just said something that could be a bit problematic. Okay. You said shake it almost as if you controlled its exit, as opposed to you embraced it and your brain let go of the warning. And that's why I'm such a wacko about words people choose, because we don't want to develop a sense of control over these experiences. A patient might say, the therapy is working. I employed this strategy, like what you said about, oh, come and bite me now, shark in the pool, I'm willing to be eaten. And you said, oh, and the anxiety went away, which is very common. But if you get hooked on saying, bite me now, so the anxiety will go away, your brain will turn around and it will like not give you that relief, because it will test, is it okay if the anxiety doesn't go away? So for the anxiety to go away, there's this amazing thing called a paradox. In other words, the more we welcome feeling anxious and show that the presence of anxiety is irrelevant, the more likely our brain's going to be, well, if this is irrelevant, I don't need to send you a warning signal. But if we look at anxiety as being something that shouldn't be there or that we should be in control over, that's what really turns around and bites us in the tushy, because our attempt at controlling or escaping anxiety actually has the paradoxical effect of keeping it around or even intensifying it. Oh, look, I use this magical word that Steve told me of bring it on, and it's still here. Oh, my God. And they come in and say, the therapy stopped working. And I'm like, well, you're telling me that therapy stopped working. That means you never understood the therapy in the first place, because it's not supposed to work. We're not supposed to have a control over a system that we have no control over. And if we're trying to get control over that system, it's going to blow up on us and we're going to have twice problems rather than just OCD, because now you're going to suffer from an overattachment to control, which many people with OCD do come in with an overattachment to control. So your teeny little nuances give me a great opportunity to expound upon exactly these principles, once again, of the brain system and then the gatekeeper's ability to manage and identify the brain system so that it can, you know, use and deploy skills of acceptance rather than, you know, skills that facilitate the brain shutting up or turning off.
Yeah. Yeah, no, thanks for explaining. And my ego wants to clarify now, which is I knew going into that the second time because I predicted it was going to trigger another kind of panic attack. And obviously I was anxious about that. But I knew that, yeah, I knew that by pushing it away was just going to keep it there longer and I needed to allow it and feel it. Yeah. And but yeah, so it was a poor word choice on my part. I had the right strategy.
I appreciate your poor word choice because it gave me an opportunity to kind of pontificate. And you know, Stu, at this point, I love opportunities to pontificate.
Yeah.
And in terms of your damaged ego, if you read the choice article again, you'll realize that no ego is the best ego.
Easier said than done, that one.
Well, correct. It takes a little bit of practice. But when we live a no ego life, it doesn't get damaged because it's not there in the first place.
That's true. I've only got 10 minutes left. So I'm thinking about questions. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Is there any way of nurturing that gatekeeper voice?
You know, there's a facet of psychology, I think it's called self-compassion. And so, you know, when we learn these systems, you know, it's like I said, you know, I give my brain license and permission to conjure up anything at this point. I would never judge any associations that my brain machine comes up with. And I can tell you that my brain machine, it can be very, what might be universally judged, not by myself, of course, but very dark. My brain comes up with really dark, really kind of creative associations. And I don't judge anything my brain shares with me, nor do I look at it ever as an indication of some quality about me as a person, some evidence of my identity or character in any way. And I think that's probably, you know, one of the most important things a person can take away is in the skills of the mindful, you know, kind of awareness and observation of the brain activity to give it that total license, go anywhere, say anything about anyone at any time, you know, on any topic. I think that is a really huge part of that, you know, quote unquote, self-compassion. That's obviously not a phrase from Dr. Phillips because I never used the word self, but in terms of just association for what many people in psychology are using, I think that that kind of license giving to the brain's independence can be tremendous.
Yeah, absolutely.
You give your brain total license to come up with anything, anytime about anyone, any topic?
I've been working on having self-compassion for my brain of like if I think something mean or horrible or dark outside of OCD. Obviously, when I say that, I mean I don't just want to talk about OCD. It's easy to beat yourself. Why did I think that? Why did I? And I don't want to give examples. I had a really horrible one.
And see what you just did again. You know, why did I think that? That's exactly the whole purpose of today's conversation. Why did I think that? I didn't think that.
No, exactly.
Why did my brain share this association with me? Why would my brain share that type of association? And to me, the answer is it's just testing. You know, our brain is amazingly conditioned to send us information predominantly as a survival mechanism. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's at night and we hear a little crackle noise, our brain still thinks that we're in a cave, you know, 200,000 years ago, and that crackle noise could be a mouse or it could be a saber-toothed tiger, which, by the way, I know saber-toothed tigers didn't exist 100,000 years ago, but I always say that just for comedic license. But that our brain conjures up these associations, I think, once again, as a test. Is it okay, Stu, from Mr. Brain, if he says, you know, let's say take your beautiful little daughter and hold her under in the bathtub. You know, that if your brain comes up with that association, that you look at your brain, even though that may not be an OCD topic, and to say, yeah, brain, thanks for sharing. And that's really, through my brain's history, as it's come up with many, 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 what society would call dark associations. Mm-hmm. My favorite response to my brain is, thanks for sharing. And within that, I'm giving that machine 100% license to share with me whatever it chooses. Yeah. So I'm sort of a stickler for catching people say, I had this thought when you didn't have the thought.
Fair point. I find that the OCD thoughts are much easier for me to treat as kind of trash and rubbish. And it's the non-OCD thoughts that are the darker thoughts that occur to me or my brain sends me that I've had to work on more because they don't feel like OCD thoughts. They make them feel more real.
But that's just it, Stu, is that, you and I could spend hours. Matter of fact, next time you're in New York, we're on the boat. Let's spend hours talking about whose brain is more creative and more dark before we jump in the water and you get eaten by a shark. Yeah. And by the way, where I sail, there are no sharks, or at least it's like a 1 in a million chance that you would be bitten by one. We'll talk about that at another time. But we could spend hours sharing whose brain has the darker association. And you're calling it non-OCD thought, but it's just brain activity. Yeah. OCD activity that becomes paired with your distress signal, that's where your OCD comes into the picture. You can't look at it like you're sort of doing that funny thing to say, oh, well, if it's an OCD thought, then it's okay because I have OCD and OCD people have these types of creative thoughts. Whereas, to say like if you've got the type of brain that I do, you would be like on suicide watch because my brain is very dark and very, very creative. But once again, I give it 100% license to come up with anything at any time.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair point. I was going to say, there's something about comedians and especially some comedians that because they can be funny, it gives them the license to say the most heinous, horrible things. And I quite like dark humor. And I mean, that puts these dark thoughts in a light way and it allows you to see them as irrelevant. And
now you have a comedian in the UK called Jimmy Carr.
Yep.
You've heard of him?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
So one of the things I like about Jimmy Carr, other than his laugh, which I do not like, is
that. Oh, yeah, it's horrible.
But other than that, I mean, he's decided under the umbrella of comedy that there are no taboos.
Yeah.
And I really like and respect that. It's great that he hasn't been canceled in this canceled society, that he makes fun of child abuse. He makes fun of homosexuality. He makes fun of a lot of topics that have been deemed completely, off the radar. And yet he says, I'm going to do this. I'm going to pair humor with taboo material. And I think in a way, what he does as a comic, we all can do between our gatekeeper value system and our brain material to give it that same license that Jimmy Carr gives himself under the umbrella of comedy.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a joke, or equally, it's just a thought. There's no...
It's just brain material.
Yeah.
And no limits, no constraints.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And it's a work in progress, I guess, for anyone listening. Change the topic. Do you have a favorite quote?
I'm laughing because I'm actually a connoisseur of quotes. Some I've actually written myself. So I'll share with you an original. And then I'll share with you a non-original. An original quote, it's one of my favorites, and it's a bit controversial, but I think it's very valid in terms of the way we relate to relationships. And so to get myself into a bit of hot water, I'll put myself out on the limb because that's what you do to me, Stu. You're so naughty. So my favorite Phillipson quote is, the person you date is not the person you're engaged to. And the person you're engaged to is not the person you're married to. And the person you're married to is not the parent of your children. In other words, we think that we know who we're with. And I'm not saying that they become worse over time, but we reformat how we conduct ourselves in relationships based on the identity and the label of those relationships. So the way that we give each other a license to do things dating may not be the same license as an engaged person or as a spouse or as a parent of our shared children. So that's my favorite, because I do a lot of relationship counseling. So I do mention that Phillipson quote. A non-Phillipson quote that I like a lot is, what does it gain a man to gain the world and lose his soul? What does it profit a man to gain the world and lose his soul? And do you know who said that, Stu?
The Bible.
Yes, it was said by Jesus. Now, I'm not a religious person, but I think there's a lot of merit to, you know, focusing on our deeper values over our profit motives. So those are two quotes. But I actually write many, many sayings, and I quote many, many quotes. Another one I have to share with you. I say this one all the time. It's by an American author, and his saying is, humans live lives of quiet desperation. His name is Thoreau. Mm. And I think it reminds us that for all of us humans, that walking on this planet is a difficult and sometimes lonely and sometimes dark path for all of us. People spend so much time thinking that their life is so burdened and that others live these happy Instagram, Facebook, you know, lives of adventure and fun. And Thoreau and then what's his name? Buddha, who says that life is suffering. That we it's important that we remind ourselves that life is not a bowl of cherries for anyone and that we all really struggle with many, many things in our lifetime.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing that life is a bowl of cherries, but a few of them are rotten. You know, on occasion you're going to bite one of those, but that's okay because the next one may be ripe. And then lastly, is there anything else that you wish you could have said today?
I've been very verbose, happy to have filled up our little time together. So offhand, nothing comes to mind. See, I'll check my notes here. I think I covered the majority of the bases that I had intended to, if not entirety of it. So I'm very happy with the coverage that we had today on this, I think, critical, critical topic.
Yeah. Yeah, nice. I think it's going to resonate with people. Hopefully the exercise was useful to illustrate and put me on the spot. So
I will never get over you and the sharks in the tub. That's one of my favorite things you've ever shared with me.
As long as I get over it, that's all that matters.
Well, apparently we're going to have to work on that next time you make it to New York.
Yeah, I'll jump in. Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it as always.
It's good times always, Stu.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. For more information, please click the link in the episode description. A quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.